It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
We will have a moment of truth on November 3rd, and that's where we'll start here on Viewpoint Presents. Welcome to the program, friends. This is Malcolm along with Michael Johns. A big program for you today. We'll talk about the debates, the predictions, interesting predictions, by the way, and some of the polls. But also, let's take a look back also at President Trump's accomplishments, both pre-coronavirus and post-coronavirus. We'll take a look at some of that as well. And here's a big question for you on the education front. Does the government have a monopoly on educating your children? One of the old telltale quotes that is oftentimes attributed to Abraham Lincoln, but of course they always say he really didn't say this, but whoever said this was smart to figure it out, and that is, the best way to predict the future is to choose it. And boy, I'll tell you what, Michael, that to me, that quote rings in my ears. The best way to predict the future is to choose it. And that's kind of where America is right now, leading up to election 2020, November 3rd. Coming quick, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure, it sure is, Malcolm. I think we're under 100 days now. Every day is going to really be a battle that can be won or lost based on messaging. And, you know, the American people, I think, post-Labor Day especially, really start to dive into reflecting upon the choice they're going to make. We don't have a large segment of undecided voters out there. We've talked about the momentum and energy that I think still is driving a lot of the Trump base and how it's lacking behind Biden. And, you know, then the question of how campaigning this fall will actually transpire. You know, I mean, typically you would have rallies in, you know, a couple, two, three states in a given day. A lot of exposure to the public, a lot of different messaging and trying to drive up enthusiasm. And, you know, this may be done very differently. TV advertising probably disproportionately will be important in this cycle. And I think there, too, it's important to note that, you know, the Trump campaign is kind of laying out, you know, a big TV schedule here with a lot of focus on the early voting states. And that's really important as it relates to the debates too, because we don't get around to the first debate until September 29th. And yet in a good number of states, voting will begin before then. So there's some degree of controversy and pressure being exerted on trying to move some of these debate schedules up earlier in the schedule and maybe even add more than the three that are currently.
Well, the president has requested both of those things. He's requested a fourth debate and he's requested to move it up. And so far, no movement at all on those. And in fact, when you really dive deeper into the whole debate thing, the venues have been changed. A lot of the initial venues in the universities said they did not want it there because of COVID-19. So you're seeing venues change. And so far, the dates are holding tight at this moment, but definitely new venues for these things. And we could talk about that a little bit later. But let me ask you this about the conventions here, Michael, first here. So this was, you know, when I seen the news bulletin, back to what you're talking about now. Well, okay. So this pandemic has changed the entire rules of engagement. This is the strangest, weirdest, most unusual election cycle we have ever by far seen. As you say, the typical rallies, the typical meet and greet, the hand, all of that's gone, you remember. Even the conventions are gone, basically, in all intent and purposes. So here was the news bulletin this past week I seen here. Joe Biden is no longer planning to accept the Democrat nomination in Milwaukee. When I first seen that, about a week or so ago that are starting to come out there, I chuckled and realizing, Michael, that, well, this just plays to the constant narrative that they want to shelter this particular candidate so he has no exposure. He's already gotten a pass from the media. He's already not in the usual, interviews and the sequence that goes with this. And then, as you say, the meet and greets. But now the convention, he's not even going to be there to accept the nomination in Milwaukee. Interesting.
Yeah, and there's obviously the political dynamic, not just the media component, but also the political dynamic of, you know, Biden wanting to, you know, project this image that the country is, you know, in such bad shape because of this pandemic. So even when we have, you know, certain metrics, whatever ones you want to look at that show that we're, starting to come out of it, or we've got improvements in certain areas, they want to dismiss those. And, you know, they want to be able to, the Biden campaign and Biden himself wants to be able to criticize the state of the country, blame it on Trump without really pointing in specificity to anything he would have done differently as it relates to preventive measures or to economic relief measures. I mean, it's a very vague, it's a sweeping allegation without any details basically attached to it, which is kind of seems to be associated with just about everything he's been saying in this campaign so far, which is really bold statements of alleging wrongdoing by the president without a whole lot of backup as far as what he would have done differently. And I think that's probably not ultimately a message as these voters do get around to pondering how they're going to vote, one that's going to go over too well.
The politicizing of the pandemic is significant, very much. This past week, Michael, I watched a lot of the left-wing broadcast, and which I shared with you, I told you, and it takes a lot for a guy like me to sit through some of those. It's almost like a straitjacket moment, you know, where you have to really buckle up and pay attention to what they're saying. But I have to tell you, they're blaming everything. You know, even the economy now, they're saying the economic conditions, it's the president's fault, the whole pandemic thing, it's his fault, not China. So what they've done is politicize this pandemic. And I think basically because nothing else has worked to be able to tarnish the president with, because he has gotten results, no matter what he has touched or what he has done or what policy has he gone after, they have all been to the conclusion of to benefit the American people, which right. to the demise of the Democrat, you know, presumptive nominee, because you have to use whatever. I mean, listen, you know full well, Michael, politics is an ugly sport. But you use whatever means you have in front of you, whatever the hell that is, to tarnish the opposing candidate. In this case, it's the pandemic and the civil unrest is what they're trying to do, is pin on the president. But they really have nothing else, do they? I mean, there's nothing else.
No, they don't. And it's almost like, I hate to be repetitive, but I keep coming back to that China travel ban and the fact that it was really the singular most important decision that any president, whoever that president was, would have made. And so we know when President Trump pulled the trigger on that, January 31, very early on. We know Biden opposed it on January 31 and on February 1, and we don't know what date he would have ultimately, if ever, ceased allowing infected individuals arriving into this country. And you cannot minimize the impact that has had. And then I think you go on and look at everything else the president's done, from the mobilization of, you know, vast resources, addressing this perceived ventilator deficiency, which turned out to be, you know, they addressed that properly. It was never really any issue. No American died because of a lack of ventilator. You look at the guidance that was offered by the federal government on distancing and on preventative measures, and those were pretty sensible. And then obviously the steps that we're making on therapeutics and on the vaccine, which looks like it's going to be approved in record speed. I mean, these vaccines are usually years in the making. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of conjecture that we might have a vaccine even before the end of the year, which would be pretty much record speed, particularly for a virus that really was unknown to the West before early this year.
I did see a poll, by the way, just about a day or so ago that said that a third of Americans would not take this vaccine, but they are predicting by year end. The president even said could be even out before the election, which experts are saying probably not. But he, of course, again, Michael, this president is an optimist. which drives them all crazy because he tries to put a silver lining on about everything, which I admire that in a leader, quite frankly, who can put a silver lining on things, even when, in fact, quite frankly, that is the sign of leadership. In fact, that defines leadership, is what it is.
Part of it.
Yeah, it's those who can put being practical, of course, and real, which you have to be to take the steps you can take. What do you think about this, Michael? What do you think about the president saying that, okay, I might just do my acceptance speech at the White House, and they all went crazy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, why not? I mean, I guess there's the question of whether there's any political or legal dimension or FCC regulation there. I have to look into that. That obviously is unprecedented. These are not going to be the typical indoor stadium acceptance speeches that the American people have been accustomed to watch. I mean, really, when you think about the convention, even before I sort of got active in this field, I always found it fascinating growing up. Watching those 4 or 5 days, you know, they kind of ascend. Each day kind of becomes a little more important than the day before, with the higher profile speakers coming out, and then ultimately the vice president accepting his nomination and the president accepting his nomination and the balloons falling and all of the celebration really around a political party putting forward a nominee and explaining why that nominee was most suited, and the floor votes, which are always intriguing, with each state offering its votes and offering the commentary on its state. It's kind of entertaining, at least as far as politics goes. And, you know, I think we're going to miss out a lot on that, not having it this year. I don't think there's any real beneficiary either way. Probably it's detrimental, if anything, to the president, simply because I think he moves a crowd, and I think the excitement around him is so significant. And I think Biden really just doesn't inspire that. I just have never seen a crowd that's really responded much. The messaging is not clear cut. The base of support, it's kind of like a Hillary Clinton nomination, like you're next in line, here it is. I mean, I don't know what it is about this man's 47 career that we're supposed to be so excited about.
Let me ask you this. I'm thinking about something here in regards to Joe Biden. So in the DNC, the Democrat Party, and it's this, when they had that large field contestants, possible presidential candidates, right. Contestants is really what it looked like. And it's funny because all these people laughed at the Republicans back in 2015, 2016, when President Trump really dismantled the entire field, legitimately, right. By the way, I might say. Now the shoe was on the other foot, and it was no longer a laughing matter when you have that many people. Well, they started to fall real quickly. And I'm just wondering, so, all right, at the end of the moment when there were just a few left, and then it became like, okay, Bernie Sanders and who? Joe Biden. Oh, my golly. Wow. I mean, those were the pickings it was left with. It was like, okay, so, like, what do we do? And I'm wondering this. So when they made the decision to they probably swallowed twice as hard on this one and, had a clump in their throat here probably and said, okay, what do we do? And I'm wondering, Michael, when they made the final decision and said, well, we got to go with Joe Biden, because you know full well the DNC, they manipulate with their all the way they do all of their the delegates, the way they do all the delegates. That's a loaded deck with the DNC.
Sure,
the super delegates.
What's a super delegate?
Exactly.
I mean,
it's like Superman.
Kind of, if you're going to read the definition of democracy, I think a super delegate is kind of runs completely contradictory, and that is that a political party, the Democrats use a lot of superdelegates, the Republicans use them too, not as many, that is basically appointed by the party to go cast their vote. Well, who's elected that person? It's not direct democracy. I think what's intriguing about the early primaries, which we've already forgotten because there's been so much news and people have been so absorbed in this pandemic, but if you really look at Biden's performance in those first few primaries, when you go through the Iowa caucuses, which he performed very poorly, and I think he was fourth, I think, then New Hampshire and South Carolina. Sure. You know, it really was a series of losses to a point where in, kind of February before Super Tuesday really began, there was a perception that he was more or less out of it, if you can recall, that he was, that his, that he'd done so poorly in those early caucuses and primaries that his candidacy was done. And then, of course, you know, kind of Super Tuesday happened, and that mm-hmm. favors well-funded candidates because you have to run simultaneously in a bunch of states, and it favors candidates who can afford a lot of TV advertising. But you cannot dismiss the fact mm-hmm. that a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters, which I think comprise a large segment of the Democrat Party, continue to be utterly disappointed and uninspired by Joe Biden.
Oh, you're so right. You're so right with what you say there. But superdelegates to me is just their way of saying, well, we'll take it from here, kids, the American people, that is. Right. We'll take it from here. Thank you. We'll decide. And of course, that's been proven through the whole episode, even when Donna Brazile was heading it up and all the funny business that was going on with superdelegates back in 2015 and 2016. We all know Hillary Clinton would not have been the nominee. It would have been Bernie Sanders had they played fair in the square back then, but they did not because they didn't want him leading the party. And Bernie knows this. I mean, he clearly knows all of this. So, which is why there's a lot of hurt feelings there in internal politics. But I think what I was driving at is when they finally got to the conclusion, like, okay, we're going to have to go with Joe Biden, and they had to do like a real self-reality check. You could just visualize these people, Michael, in the men's bathroom, banging their head against the wall, like, oh my God, don't tell me, bang. You know, it's like, because Joe Biden was not exactly a winning strategy. I mean, this is what, like the, what is this, like the 320th time he's run for president or something like that? I think I forgot the number now, but it's up there.
He's never done well. I mean, you know, I think, in fact, he's not even a little bit well. I mean, he's really been, and I think it points to the fact. I used to always joke to people. I said, if you want to go win a state, you know, a statewide office, go run in Delaware. Because, you know, you can literally get out and meet probably every voter who you need to win that election. It's one of the few states where it's so small that you can actually have that kind of populist campaign. But when it comes to national appeal, his ability to appeal in the upper Northeast, and the Midwest, especially in the West, I just don't think he resonates. And now we're dealing with a Joe Biden that is not the Joe Biden of 20 years ago.
He simply
looks robotic, ill-prepared, unsuited for the office.
Well, but listen, then you have to ask yourself, but here's what nobody's asking, Michael. What you just say is very accurate, but then you have to ask yourself and say, well, then why would the Democrat powers to be, the betters in the Democrat Party, I'm saying, why all of a sudden would they give this to a Joe Biden? I mean, if they had such a stellar field of contestants coming into the game show of who's going to be our Democrat nominee, I mean, why would you pick a guy who's tried so many times and never come close, kind of bumbles on all of it, and here's why they did it. So why did he become the senior? Well, it's because what I'm trying to point out is what you've been saying. If the rules weren't just right, if they didn't think, Michael, that they could use this pandemic to the best of their ability, I think they did the math real quick and said, you know what? This is going to play like a charm. We'll use Joe Biden as a poster child for what we really want, even though he can't deliver. And we'll hide behind all these things. We won't have a convention. He won't have to talk. We don't have to do any rallies. My golly, we don't have to do any of this. And so a lot of people are even predicting right now there may not even be any debates that they're going to try to find a way to get out of that. We don't know how. But I don't see how they get out of that. But the point is, you see what I'm saying? They twisted everything at this point, and then they said, well, you know what? Let's just give it to Joe Biden. He was the least possible qualified candidate on that stage of all the contestants, as I would say. Yeah, he's the guy they're going with.
But it's important, I think, to remember there is motive behind all of this, in the sense that, you know, Bernie Sanders is to the Democrat Party what Donald Trump was to the Republican Party. In nominating Bernie Sanders, you are making a decision to transform that party, meaning Joe Biden, when you put him in the room with big Democrat donors and corporate representatives, knows how to nod yes, and he knows how to kind of follow the directive of the establishment that governs today's Democrat Party. Bernie Sanders pushes back and rebels against it. Donald Trump's victory in 2016, I've pointed out many times, wasn't just winning the presidency, but transforming the Republican Party, putting issues on the platform that really had been neglected for decades in the way of trade and immigration, border security. They only had paid lip service to these issues for decades. Now all of a sudden, he was a president who basically ran and won on those issues. And I don't think that, I think the Republican Party was ready to transform in the sense that grassroots Republicans saw that their message was beginning to be diluted and they weren't really resonating with middle-income Americans, especially like they needed to. The Democratic Party has not undergone that internal transformation yet. Socialists are knocking on the door. They're banging on the door. They're starting to gently kick the door. Things I'm sure are going to ultimately escalate. These people are not going away. They're not going to be accommodated with half measures or symbolic gestures. And I notice even AOC maybe not speaking in any capacity in this convention. There's some interesting decisions that they're going to have to make about what kind of face they want to put forward really to the American people. Are they, because they can't alienate the socialist base and they're afraid that if they embrace it, they're going to lose any chance of national relevance or political sellability.
Yeah, they've been trying to shut down a lot of those secondary voices, exactly like AOC and the Squad and some of the more outspoken people in the Democrat Party. But I would also say to you that I think they have been transforming the Democrat Party. They have been successful with transforming it into a socialist Marxist party. That is the debate and the argument that will continue on is, and you know, we've been all over that story. They are no longer the Democrat moderate party of JFK. They're so far removed from those fairy tale days, Michael, you know, I mean, they're long gone.
Look at the two issues. Look at the two issues that really motivate the socialist left right now. It's the Green New Deal, right? That's one. And it's Medicare for all. Yeah. Well, now you get a candidate who's pretty far left, but he doesn't really embrace either of those completely. So he's kind of stuck in between nothing. And he's stuck between two big masses of voters and not really identifying with either one of them.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Exactly it. Well said. Well, listen, we never have enough time here. I wanted to talk more about the predictions, some interesting predictions I'll just share with people quickly. And we'll talk more about this later if we have the time. But how do I say to you, experts within both the Democrat and the Republican Party who are predicting, who predicted other races, in other words, and they're predicting this race. And I just chuckle at this, people, because one predicts a Joe Biden win and one predicts a President Trump win. And these are people who supposedly have predicted a lot of previous elections. Oh, well, so much for predictions, huh? And what happens? And then again, there are the polls, and the polls that are being predicted that, well, Hillary Clinton was going to win 2016. At this point, Joe Biden's going to win. And those are just the polls, and those also don't fit the narrative, do they, people? So what does that leave? Well, that leaves we the people, and that leaves what I said to you up front, that famous quote here, the best way to predict the future is to choose it. And you know what? Those are the best words I think we can all, that should resonate with each of us as we rev up now for election 2020. You gotta choose it, people. You gotta choose what kind of a future you want. Is the future of America that shines city on a hill, that beautiful republic? Is that the city is that the city we want? Is that the nation of America? Is it capitalism? Is that the future for our country? Is the Constitution the future for our country? Is that what we hold to? Or are we going to a socialist Marxist future? Does that become, there's a choice. I mean, you have a choice here. So it's going to be time very soon to predict that future here. Well, we're going to move the conversation along here and take a pause here and then talk about some of these pre and post coronavirus things you need to know. A lot of people are forgetting and they need not to forget. And you know what? We're going to give you a gentle reminder in just a moment on what success metrics really look like. Michael Johns has got some great facts and figures for you that I think you should know about. And you need to take some of this information and drive this narrative out there so that our fellow Americans are well aware of what the stakes are coming into election 2020. We'll pause a moment here, friends, and there'll be more Viewpoint Presents in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
The bigger piece of this entire conversation, my friends, is this. It's called the economy, and the economy is a big factor in all of this because it always is. I mean, people typically vote with their wallets, and they vote with what's going to be best for their lives and their families, and that's what it is. It always comes back to that. So there is a point now where we need to remind our fellow Americans as to some of the pre-coronavirus components of this thing. You know, we historically had it was the most successful economy we had ever seen in our lifetimes. And people felt very good. Again, if you go back just to last November, which I always say to you, you know, Michael, I will tell you something. I seen an interesting piece in Breitbart. I just want to share with you here. And I think it plays a little bit to these pre-coronavirus accomplishments, which we'll talk about now. And it was this, and you'll love this. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but Michelle Obama, it was about her, and the headline was this: the Trump administration hypocrisy giving me low-grade depression. I don't know if you've seen that, but it was quite something. And the former first lady said that she is dealing with some form of low-grade depression because of the quarantine, right, the racial strife, the seeing this administration, watching the hypocrisy of it day in and day out, which kind of plays to this whole pandemic and that people are, people chuckled at the fact that the former first lady was depressed, but I think a lot of Americans can relate to that, quite frankly. Let's remind people, Michael, of last November, if we roll back the clock to, again, last November is the great mark I like to choose because this was prior to any corona pandemic talk whatsoever. We weren't even talking early stages of it coming from China yet. Where were we? What kind of a country did we have? And what were some of those accomplishments?
Well, that's what sort of, I think, makes this a more objective choice, because we are really going to make an assessment here between an individual who was the vice president for 8 years, eight very unremarkable years in my judgment, versus a president who, if you take coronavirus out of it and look at the first 3 years, really had made extraordinary progress in delivering what he promised the American people and then some. 7.3 million jobs were created between January 2017 and the coronavirus. He obviously put in place the Tax Cuts and Job Act, biggest piece of tax reform legislation and tax cuts in three decades, which was very much focused on middle class earners. 82% of middle class earners in the United States experienced tax relief because of President Trump's measure. Parents were beneficiaries of this. He doubled the child tax credit, which added an additional $1,000 in deductibility for parents, doubled the standard deduction, cut taxes for small business, and importantly, on the corporate rates, which you might recall under Obama and Biden were 35%. We were the highest really in the industrialized world, brought that down to 21%, which puts us in a much more competitive position with industrialized countries of the world. It also was a big part of the repatriation of money that was being held off seas by companies and individuals because they did not want to be subjected to these high tax rates. So it's brought back trillions of dollars into the United States economy. Of course, 8 years under Obama and Biden, not 1 year, first president in the history of this country to not have gross domestic product grow 3%. And President Trump, of course, had over 3% in four quarters, and certainly absent coronavirus, I think would have accomplished that. Was very close in 19 and had unemployment at the lowest level in 50 years. And for African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians, the lowest unemployment rates ever since
historically
been measured.
Historically, yeah. Weren't we about, wasn't Obama usually his numbers, as I recall, and as I remember, on the top of my mind, his numbers normally were around 1% growth, weren't they? Usually around there?
Yeah, not one exceeded three, and right. You know, many quarters were in the negatives. And famously, you might recall Biden and Trump basically both saying that manufacturing jobs were gone, that we needed to kind of get used to this new normal of what you and I have talked about, which is this managed decline of the United States basically losing its position. And remember, if you will recall, Obama said you needed a magic wand is what he had asked to bring these jobs back. And of course, Trump created 500,000 jobs in manufacturing with these tax cuts and regulatory relief, really put into a position of saying, hey, you don't need a magic wand. You just need the right policies, which of course, Obama and Biden never really took the initiative of trying to do.
I heard the president reference that magic wand, by the way, Michael, the other day at a press conference when he reminded Americans the fact that he's going to get that magic wand again and make the jobs happen. I think it was a real telling moment. Let's not lose sight of what we're talking about right now. It was a real telling moment as you look back, my friends, at the Obama legacy that was, and you look at the things that Michael's pointing out about, you got an average of growth in the GDP. Really was very meager, and that one and change percent ratio was very common, a theme coming from the Obama economy. But part of the reason, I think, Michael, that it doesn't get enough credit is that this president wants to get out of the way, and he wants to let the might of the American people and American ingenuity and American innovation shine. That really is his moment where he says, let's put, give the right tools to the American people. And you said it a moment ago when you actually said 82% of Americans benefited because I believe you were suggesting, I think you said, because of his change in regulations, and
nobody gives the tax cuts.
Nobody gives this president enough credit for stepping out of the way of regulations. He doesn't like red tape. This guy has got a really fantastic CEO mentality, which, you know, as a CEO, you come into the corporate boardroom and you say, well, how do we get it done? Let's get it done. Let's get people out of the way and get results. That's what he's trying to do here.
If you recall on regulations, which is interesting, I mean, when he first came in, everyone's sort of knows that you sort of issues that emerge that do require some sort of federal regulatory structure. But he had said, look, for every new regulation we're going to put in place, I want two eliminated. Mm-hmm. So as part of that, you had really substantial reductions in the regulatory burden that was representing, you know, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars of cost onto American companies and costs onto our companies and not costs onto companies abroad. One of the many reasons wanted to get out of the Paris environmental deal was that, you know, basically it was an income redistribution scheme where the largest polluter in the world, China, would not have been forced to incur any of the costs associated with it, which of course is another great accomplishment of this president that I think will be highlighted this fall, that we have this very flawed Iran agreement where Obama and Biden turned over billions of dollars to the largest state sponsor of terrorism in Iran. And we're embracing this Paris Agreement, which was basically an income redistribution scheme where we would send money all over the world in the ostensibly to support environmental initiatives while the largest polluter was exempted from it. All these regulations that would be imposed on the U.S. And, you know, really all of these major issues, immigration. I mean, what did Obama and Biden do in 8 years? No construction of any border wall, no real serious effort to view the illegal immigration crisis as a crisis, as it impacted wages in this country, as jobs were taken by illegals, as the incidence of crime went up and up. Took this president to come in and say, we're going to basically put that to an end, and he's obviously gotten a lot of pushback from Congress on it, or we'd be further along. But, you know, a lot of progress made with the border wall, and taking illegal alien crime seriously, taking the presence of Central American gangs seriously. All of those are issues that we can tend to forget in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic, but I think have been profoundly beneficial for this country.
You know, I asked up in the first hour of the program, Michael, I had asked a Senator Ron Johnson about the China-Russia component. There's a lot of reports with intelligence right now and reports that China wants Trump defeated, you know, clearly. And of course, back to the Russia narrative that they're trying to sabotage Biden, they're saying. So one wants one to win, one wants the other to win. What I want to ask you is regards to China, specifically, when you talk about Joe Biden and you talk about Barack Obama's administration, which was the Obama-Biden administration. So their whole point of gutting out American manufacturing and gutting out our jobs, which the jobs reports were, I mean, we were decimated as a country back in those 8 to 10 years. Through the end of the Bush administration into really the prime of the Obama administration. And when you look at the relationship that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, his son, had with China, or as the president says, China. So, I mean, you have to question now, Michael, that, you know, with all this said, and now with the election being questioned, the interference, the foreign interference in the election, who would be better suited to take our country forward? As far as, I mean, our biggest adversary, I think everybody, you can't argue this with me. Nobody can argue, is China. If you say anything different than China, you're lying to me, whoever that is out there, because it is
yeah,
China.
Either lying or uneducated. I mean, it's self-evident on every single front that China, I mean, they literally have a plan in place to surpass the U.S.
So who's best to do this for us, buddy? Who's best to take it forward?
Best to lead less to, this president is the first president of our lifetimes, really, or of the last few decades, at least, to kind of put forward the sensible policies that are needed against China. We're challenging China's global expansionism in the South China Sea in an assertive way. We've been taking unfair China trade policies to task. We've put tariffs on China's exports. We've addressed their currency manipulation. We've been pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council in large part once China was put on the council. I mean, we've been engaged in just about every level, kicking out and even arresting Chinese intelligence operatives and individuals who were involved in intellectual property theft in this country on China's behalf. I think there's been an awakening really under this president's watch to the reality that China's presence, even in the United States through its embassies and consulates, has been, you know, almost a criminal syndicate, and that we have had in China, you know, undeniably, in my view, outside of North Korea and Iran, perhaps the worst human rights conditions in the world, you know, 2 to 3 million Uyghurs in detention camps, Hong Kong being steamrolled, its independence, China violating its agreement on Hong Kong's future. And all of this coronavirus role, which I think is yet to be addressed, but has to be and will be addressed, and that is that the if you're looking for someone to blame for this, you have to blame the Communist Party of China. I mean, they basically allowed individuals to get on airplanes in these exposed areas in Wuhan and elsewhere and fly all over the world while they simultaneously were not allowing these individuals to leave that province. That's a knowing maliciousness that I think guided exporting this virus to the world and costing the lives of so many and economic misery and costs, you know, into the trillions.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about election interference, okay, what do you, you know, there's a lot of talk about, like you say, with China and Russia, and you mentioned Iran is another one. Now, Iran, they're doing a lot of campaigns behind the scenes with social media and other to confuse Americans, the same thing that China and Russia are doing. But none of this, as Senator Johnson pointed out earlier, none of this is historically new. As he said on the record, they've done this for decades. They've always done this. Everybody has done this.
Absolutely. All the way back to 1960, Russia has been involved in every election in this country. It just, no one made an impeachment a major investigation out of it until this year. We've always had counterintelligence capabilities that have looked at it and are well aware of it. I don't think Russia's been able to influence any federal election in this country ever, but no one can question their intent to try to do that, and they'll try to do it again.
Let me ask you a serious question, and let's see what you
think. Aren't all your questions serious?
They are all serious. But here's even a more serious one. So, all right, if we're talking about really, truly election interference, and then so on one side of the coin here, Michael, we have, again, China, Russia, Iran. Those would be the three big ones I would speak about when we're talking about election interference. And then on the other side of the coin, Michael, we have, okay, the mainstream media, we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have Google. If you're talking about, this is why I preface this by saying this is a serious question, because this is probably the most important question coming into election 2020. When we look at everything in the playing field right now, at truly having an honorable election in this country, with those two camps, what is the biggest threat to our fellow Americans?
Well, the biggest threat continues to be that we have a president who's doing all the right things against opposition on every front that you just mentioned. I mean, he's got, you know, Silicon Valley against him. He's got major powers of the world against him. He's got all of these entities against him. He's got the media against him, all because he's trying to do what's right for this country. And you cannot underestimate the power, interest, or momentum behind anti-American forces in this world. They're well-funded. They're strategic. They've been at it a long time. They have identified, I think, some areas of vulnerability in our country that they're looking to exploit, have been exploiting. They're trying to tear the country in two. They're even having some success with that. And I think this president sees through it, and he's one of the biggest impediments, really, to them being able to get to the point they want to get to politically. Mm-hmm. The only other thing that can stop them is the American people, which is why grassroots political involvement in this country continues to be so vital for conservatives and essential, really, for us to be ultimately politically successful.
Yeah. So I got to ask you. All right. Fair enough. So before we get on to education, and this is going to be a really very cool segment here ahead with on this new Rand Paul plan we're going to tell you about, friends, in a moment here. Before we do, Michael, let's talk about just take a moment and talk about post-coronavirus accomplishments as well in the post era now, since all this has happened, the steps the Trump administration is taking. How would you label that at the very top of the heap? What are some of the things we're talking about in the post era here?
Well, once again, all the negative news on the economy has gotten a lot of attention. I mean, every screaming headline about jobs lost throughout this winter and spring was, you know, pretty bold. But has anyone pointed out that 9.3 million jobs have been created in this country over the last 3 months? We had 4.8 million in June, an all-time record in the history of job creation. Another 1.8 million just announced this past week for July. And this, despite the fact that we got governors all over this country that are Democrat governors that are, you know, being very slow to reopen. So even with that amount of impediment and pushback, the president is, you know, bringing this country's economy back from the worst pandemic of modern times. And he's doing it with all the appropriate policies. You know, I mean, they took the impact on the economy really seriously. They made very constructive steps to protect small business, to keep employees connected to their employer. Now the promise to potentially suspend the payroll tax, which I hoped had been done earlier, for the rest of the year. That will be very beneficial for hiring entities and for American working people. You know, I just think thankful that we've got a president who understands how jobs are created and how they're kept, and is taking the steps in the middle of all this, because with misguided policies, I'm not sure we would ever get through or correct this.
That's right. That's right.
Completely.
Yeah. Well, we're talking again. I always look at this as American ingenuity, American exceptionalism, and American might. And, you know, my fellow Americans, there is nothing to me that is our most valuable asset. I mean, make no mistake about it, is you out there. It's we, the people. I just love this nation, love our country, and love our American people. And there's nothing like it on the planet here. So congratulations to all of you out there, I think, for making this. And that's what you're seeing here. And I believe that is a moment of optimism for all of us to know. We will not only get through this chapter, people, but we will surpass all expectations and prevail on the highest order, is what I predict here as we get through this election cycle. So So listen, you are listening to Viewpoint. Now, Viewpoint is our world-class news magazine, and you hear this program every Sunday. So it starts with the first hour of Viewpoint this Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific on the West Coast. We have a great audience on the West Coast, so join us there at 7 as well. But 10 a.m. is the first thing, and the second hour Viewpoint Presents really gives us an opportunity, as you're seeing right now, to do a deep dive onto things we would never be able to do in the upfront hour, which is really a fast-paced news magazine. That was the intent. And by the way, this November, we will be celebrating 3 big years of Viewpoint, just right at the election cycle, 3 big years of Viewpoint. So again, bookmark us now 10 to 12 every Sunday morning. This is where you'll get it, right here on America Out Loud Talk Radio. And later in the day, 6 to 8 as well, it's back with you there on the Talk Radio Network. The show also goes to podcast networks worldwide. When I say podcast, I mean Spotify and Stitcher and iHeart Podcast. And there are so many podcast networks we're on. And of course, Apple Podcasts, Android, all of them. And all these links, by the way, are on the navigation bar at America Out Loud. If you go there and just go to the very simply to the podcast network, subscribe to podcast on the sidebar there, you'll get a whole lot of the networks and information there that you can subscribe to and listen. So, and you'll catch it all at AmericaOutLoud.com as well. Sunday afternoon, that is, after 2 p.m. Eastern Time, you'll get that all on podcast throughout the world and on the front page of America Out Loud. We're on the front pages here, people, and on the front lines to help you all out understand what the stakes are in our great republic here. Up next here, again, is this education piece. Very, very fascinating. New Rand Paul plan that really wants to empower struggling families amid the COVID-19 school closures. And I think the big question I would ask you to think about while we pause a moment here is, and think about this a moment here, does the government have a monopoly on educating your children? That's a big question, and we'll have some big answers in just a moment. Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutLoud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio. So it is an interesting way to frame this discussion up about the government have a monopoly on educating. And let me explain to you what we mean by that, and we'll bring this out to you, is that it's a conversation every so often that is talked about, but not enough, and there never seems to be a resolution to this, is that the American people have no choice, really, many of them. And I'm talking about working people. I'm not talking about the rich and the elite here. I'm talking about working people, basically. And so, Michael, what it is this. You know, the reason I frame it that way, and I want to read you this interesting setup here for this, and because it really is about choice. In the article, there's a very interesting article on the Foundation for Economic Education, the FEE, and it talks about under the status quo, taxpayer dollars fund government schools, not education. So here's the catch. Americans are taxed to provide federal education funding, ostensibly for the education of their children and others. But the money goes to finance public schools, regardless of whether those students end up attending them. This article goes on to say, if families choose to homeschool, and see, this is all because of this COVID now, has brought a lot of this to the light of day. But if families do choose to homeschool or send their children to private schools, the taxpayer money marked for their school education still goes to the public school, and the family is left to cover the actual cost of the kids' school and on their own. This means, in most cases, low-income families who have no choice but to send their children to public schools, even if these very schools are failing their students, which many people would argue they are, and unless you have the deep pockets of an Obama family who clearly send their children to private school, this is what you would have to succumb to. What do you think about this, Michael?
Yeah, there's a lot you can learn by that Obama example. I mean, he looked at the D.C. public schools that his two daughters would have gone to and said, you know, I don't think I like those. I don't like the environment there. I don't like the graduation rates. I don't like the violence of drugs, and sent them off to very expensive private schools. Most Americans, of course, can't afford that. And that's why this Rand Paul bill, Senate Bill 4432, is very consistent with the arguments we've made for a long time now about the need for school choice. And that is that American children learn at different in different ways. School qualities are different from city to town to, you know, state to state. I mean, there's no monolithic way to go about educating. We need to stop thinking in terms of one singular approach. Start realizing that the best education is education that's tailored to an individual child who may be really exceptionally gifted and would benefit from gifted education, may need tutoring, would benefit from tutoring, may do better in a private school, may do better in homeschooling. All of these are should be options. So the vast majority of funding for education in this country, 90% of it, comes from the state, 10% comes from the federal government, parts of which are dedicated to school lunch programs and things like that. The idea behind this Rand Paul initiative, which of course only addresses the 10% of the federal funding, is one that I think should be embraced on all state levels, and that is that you want the funding to follow the child, the student, not the institution.
That's right.
So in this case, and we're in this kind of hybrid right now of education where some students are going back to school, some are, you know, we're doing it remotely. Some are even being given the choice on what they want to do. We want to see them funded individually so that they can make the selection that's best for them.
Yeah.
And this federal funding now would provide support really for whatever the student wanted to do within the boundaries, obviously, of education, but things like curriculum materials and tech education materials, tutoring, extracurricular activities, private school tuition, all of that could be used as an option. I think that's entirely sensible, and it also recognizes the individuality of children and their respective learning needs.
What we're talking about here is giving the power back to the people, the power back to people to decide what is best for their kids. Now, this is called the School Act, by the way, the Rand Paul movement here, and I credit the senator for bringing this up, especially at this time. He realized probably, Michael, that this is probably an opportunity with the change in education system over the last 6 months and now coming into a new season with COVID and the way people are dealing with it. But this way, the funding would flow to whatever's best for the kids. Michael, this should have been done already. I mean, this should.
Oh yeah, this is common. This is common sense education policy. Any free society knows that you improve a service or product when you have greater competition. And yet, when it comes to education, we've fallen into this belief that there's some monolithic building.
Right.
Through which all learning is presumably is transferred from these teachers to students. And the reality is there's a lot of broken schools in this country, and even the best schools may be best for the majority of students there, but aren't perfectly suited for all students. And we have, you know, special education needs and gifted education needs and individuals who have predisposed skill sets in music and art and other fields that can blossom in an environment where they're surrounded by experts in those fields and educational focus on them. A lot, you almost have to look back and wonder how much opportunity of individuals is lost because in those crucial first 18 years of life, they're not afforded access to the type of education that would best develop their skill sets. You know, and I talk to people all the time who've come out of public schools, and you know, you have counselors who've spent almost no time with these students, teachers who, you know, some of whom are great and really put in a lot of effort, but a lot of whom are looking at the clock and thinking about what they're going to do that night and have no stake really ultimately in whether a student succeeds or fails. And all this has been perpetuated by a very powerful union in the National Education Association predominantly, which has governed American education, public education, with a iron fist. And there's nothing that is more threatening to them than the emergence of private schools and schools that fall outside of the parameters of their public domain. They don't want competition. They don't want alternatives. They don't want any funding that goes to any other source. And of course, that might be in the interest of the NEA. It's not in the interest of children who are looking for the best learning experiences.
So the big question is your instinct. What does your instinct say on this? What are the chances of this happening?
It's like every other great policy idea. It's going to have good chance of succeeding in the Senate. It's going to go nowhere in the House. And but if it's, you know, it offers an opportunity for us to try to make the argument that, you know, if you want these kind of policies, you can't be putting Biden, Pelosi, and Schumer back in leadership positions in this country in November. I think one thing that there's a number of things that hold all the American voters together, hold the American people together. I think one is that they all want good schools and good education opportunities for children, whether they have children or not. Our society and the success of our society and our country rests on that being there. And I think everyone looks at the current systems and realizes it's got, you know, in some cases, modest deficiencies, in some cases, absolutely inexcusable deficiencies where, you know, parents literally are worried that their kids are going to come home alive at night.
That's right. You know, when you're in a mindset of a big government apparatus, you really are not encouraged to want to give power to the people. And that really lines into more of a, well, it does line to a more socialist attitude where they think the powers to be, the elites and the betters and the big government apparatus, have the control of things. And that's really the problem we're dealing with here. So listen, there's all these things we're talking about have a point to the end, to freedom, to our liberty, and where the power needs to be. The power needs to be, I just can't stress this enough, to we the people. That's where it is, right here with you all. So big shout out to Senator Rand Paul for doing this at this time and looking for that opportunity. And I do believe, and I will predict, there are going to be other opportunities ahead. So while a lot of people believe it's doom and gloom in the Republic, I would suggest to you that these are challenging times, my friends, but they also are times where we can pull out the more vigorous American attitude and might and prosperity and build a better future is what we need to be looking at for all of us here. Thank you for being with us here, and Michael Johns on the mission here on Viewpoint Presents and the entire Viewpoint family. Thank you again for helping us get the story out there, friend, and make the story correct. It's a big election, big mission, and these are big times. Let's make sure we get it right. Thank you again, friends. It's time to get involved and get loud.